Good morning, good morning. Here we are with a fully produced and scripted episode, thank you very much, about what is, in my opinion, one of the most intriguing literary topics in modern Germany, Fischer Verlag Publishing. Hello and welcome back to Diddy and Hawthorne in the In-Between. I'm your host, Mackenzie Gentz, and you're listening to my podcast about the relevancy of literature in the 21st century. Now bookmark that book and let's begin. This episode contains content about the Holocaust that may upset some listeners. I'm not going to delve too far into details, but talking about the events of the Holocaust in a broad sense is integral to telling this story. If you're sensitive about the topic, please proceed with caution. My introduction to the topic of Fischer Verlag Publishing actually came from my host here in Germany. I'm staying in a very old, historic neighborhood called Grunewald here in Berlin, and the entire population of the city, much like the old town of Nuremberg, actually used to be Jewish. Now, unlike in Nuremberg, the Jewish population actually grew and stayed in Grunewald until the autumn of 1941, when Nazis started deporting Jewish families to ghettos, concentration camps, and work camps by the thousands. Within 6 months, 180 total trains carrying between 100 and 1500 people departed from Grunewald, all bound eastward. Today, much of Grunewald's Jewish culture has fortunately returned, and the events of 1941 and 1942 are memorialized through Mahnmalkreis Siebzehn, or the Memorial of Track 17. Track 17 being, of course, the departure place for the thousands of deportations from this Jewish quarter. The story behind the memorial at Gleis Siebzehn itself is also very interesting because Deutsche Reichsbahn's successor paid for it in a mass effort to begin reparations after the war, though in essence what happened in reality was that their payment was not enough to cover the entire cost of the two monuments that make up the memorial. The first, and I'm quoting here, an 18-meter concrete block with embedded silhouettes of deportees designed by Polish artist Karol Brotinowski, and the second, a commemoration of the hundreds of deportations that occurred, which is embodied in the form of metal brackets along the Bahnsteig, or platform, denoting the specifics of each departure, which comprised of architects Hirsch, Lorsch, and Wandel. In the end, it was much up to the community to finish the monuments, and finish they did, with even additions with movements such as Bucher Box, Gleis 17, a free neighborhood library that specializes in literature relating to Gleis Siebzehn and the Holocaust. Grunewald, since the 19th century, has been a haven for artists, and you can tell just by walking through the neighborhood that the houses were built to function as creative havens. A gorgeous English Tudor-style house down the street from ours belonged to both the famous German composer Engelbert Humperdinck and the famous German ballerina Isadora Duncan, so it's no wonder that Samuel Fischer, Fischer Verlag's creator, also lived in Grunewald until the publishing house's operations were forced to move to Vienna during the Second World War. Now, another concept that I've been thinking over in particular lately is that in school we always learn about literary movements in terms of their biggest proponents, which in this case are typically authors or other artists, but I've realized with my research about Fischer Verlag that the publishing houses that front these movements and these artists are just as important, because those literary movements would not have existed, at least not at that time that the authors were writing and the artists were creating, without a tremendous amount of support from people willing to put their work out into the world. For example, Fitzgerald's first novel, This Side of Paradise, was one of the first in what was essentially Fitzgerald's own movement of disillusioned, lost generation writers in the 1920s, and if it wasn't for Scribner and Sons, it's possible that the entire movement wouldn't have been discovered until much later. After all, it's incredibly difficult, even nowadays, to self-publish a book because of the enormous expense that you must undertake in terms of navigating copyright laws, representation, manufacturing, distribution, and the list goes on and on. It would have been almost impossible earlier to undertake such a large task for a single novel. Fischer Verlag is a very interesting case because it was actually a very liberal publishing house in the sense that they published authors such as Thomas Mann, Jacob Wasserman, and Sigmund Freud, but it was only a liberal publishing house, or in other words, their sole profits and standing were based off of what was at the time very artistic, ground-up literature. They also did publish two literary magazines, Freie Bühne and Neue Rundschau, but again, those two magazines did very little to supplement their original content. The reason why I'm surprised at this, by the way, is that many publishers who went through with taking literary risks, such as with Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five or with James Joyce's Ulysses, those publishing houses had other means of income to buffer what was essentially the high possibility of scorn or failure that they were undertaking. Fisher Verlag is different, however, in that their entire popularity was based off of their unusual publications, which was, of course, not really normal during the era that Nazi Germany was developing. Another question that I came upon, and the question that is indeed summative enough to end with, is, was Samuel Fisher Jewish, and does that fact matter when considering his case in a historical context? My host family, who first introduced me to this entire topic, seemed to run with the assumption that the Fisher family was indeed Jewish, based on the fact that after the war, the publishing house was determinedly focused on publishing translations and originals of Jewish-focused literature, especially relating to the Holocaust. A prime example of one such text is Der Junge im gestreiften Pyjama by John Boyne, the first book that I read in German, and coincidentally, it was a book that I bought in 2016 in London, which demonstrates really how wide-reaching such a focus for Fisher Verlag has become in terms of the literary community. After some thorough investigating into this issue, and I do mean thorough, you can check the description for some links here, I believe that the Fisher family was indeed Jewish because of Samuel Fisher's widely publicized death in sources like the Jewish Telegraphic Community, the cultural origins of the last name Fisher, their residence in Grunewald during its most Jewish era, as well as their retroactive focus on contemporary Jewish literature. However, I believe that more important from a historic standpoint were the kinds of books that Fisher Verlag published, rather than the Jewish background of its founder, due to the fact that the family's religious background was and has stayed buried, as well as the fact that the most public accounts of the institution really did focus substantially on its literature. Samuel Fisher did have control of the company for a number of years, but it was taken over by Moritz Heimann and later by poet Oscar Locke. So in terms of origins, where the firm was really notably anti-Nazi, there wasn't much left for the 1930s to trace it back to Fisher himself. I cite also the widespread instances of book burning in Nazi Germany, not the least of which occurred at Babelplatz right here in Berlin, and which is memorialized along in other ways with a quote by Heinrich Heine from 1820 that reads, "That was but a prelude. Where they burn books, they will ultimately burn people as well." The point is, though, that primary to the Nazi movement was the illusion of stringent and unified ideology, a sort of ideology that was dangerous in the way it was communicated, which was through the negative instances of propaganda that the movement generated and through instances of what the ideology wasn't, rather than what it was. Fisher, of course, was not included in their ideology, and thank goodness for that. Today, Samuel Fisher's house is memorialized in the same way as many other houses in Grunewald, the plaque that commemorates his life and work. If you enjoyed the discussion and would like to hear more from me, there is an episode of DH&I for everyone, so I'd recommend checking out our back catalog of episodes. 2019 is the year of Didion, so if you'd like to follow along in my quest to read Joan Didion's collective works or learn more about the movement to bring lit back to people, everything can be found at didionandhawthorne.blueberry.net. And remember that blueberry is spelled B-L-U-B-R-R-Y. Now you can also follow the show on Twitter with @DidionIn, 2 N's total. I'll be posting about new lit releases, reading lists, and of course the new projects and episodes relating to DH&I. Still there? One more thing then. Remember that leaving a comment or a review on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or any other Guilty Pleasure podcast platform helps leverage the show so that other literature enthusiasts can find the community. In other words, it helps a ton. Auf Wiederhören!